I've known Patty for probably going on 7 years, but it's just been the last probably 3 years that I've had the honor of spending time with her, talking with her, and sharing some things. They're telling me to speak up. I've heard Patty share her story, and I've watched her in different circles, and it's always an honor to get to talk with her. She has a strong message of hope and strength, and she always has this beautiful smile on her face, and she has a wonderful spirit, and I'm looking forward to hearing her talk again, so I'm not going to take any of her time. Please welcome Patty G.
Can I move this? I could do this, I guess. Hi, my name's Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. It's not going to be much different, I don't think. You'll be thinking I'm on my knees. Oh my gosh, I'm very nervous. It's always an honor. If you'll bear with me just a few minutes, I'll settle down. It's always an honor to be with my sisters and my brothers, and with my sisters tonight to share my experience, strength, and hope. Arla called me a long time ago and asked me if I would speak, and I said I would. And then I said, you know, I didn't get to see her, but if I had, and if she, you know, had said, you know, about me talking, and I just said, I said, what? Are you sure that was me? Because the closer it gets, you know, the more nervous I become, and I get really scared. And although I do enjoy sharing my experience, strength, and hope, and also equally, I love to hear other people share their experience and hope, because that's how I stay strong. And I just want to say thank you to Lori for introducing me, and Lori truly is my sister, because they like this conference. You know, we have our Native American AA convention in November. This will be our 10th one, and they, you know, Native Americans are getting sober all across the nation. And we probably, as far as I know, we probably have the only Native American AA convention on the East Coast, at least wise of our size. And it started out that 10 years ago, or a little bit before that, 10, 12 years ago, I was living in Oklahoma, and I got to attend several sobriety campouts and AA conventions, and it was incredible, because we have such a high rate of alcoholism among Native Americans. It felt so wonderful to be in a room this size and to have it full of sober Indians. That's an incredible feeling. And so when I came back in April, I spoke in Tulsa, and I came back and I said, guys, what do you think about us having a conference, a convention? And they were very supportive and open to it, but I don't think they believed in it. And so, you know, we started planning, and this was in April. We're going to have our first one in November. First of all, we're alcoholics. We want it now. We didn't know how we were going to do it. So, you know, rolled around, July rolled around. We're shooting for $5,000 and to try to get, you know, get some seed money going. And we're having bake sales, and we're doing this, and we're doing that, and there's about, sometimes there'd be about 8 of us, and sometimes there'd be 10 of us, sometimes there'd be 2 of us, and so we're sitting there mid-July and at our meeting, and And I'm all pumped up, and I'm excited about this convention coming up in November. And they said, you know, we're talking, and said, how much money do we have? And I said, $32.19. Now, you talk about the seed of faith, though, to carry the message, you know. And now we are on our 10th one coming up, and I want to welcome each and every one of you. If you want more information, let Lori know, or myself, or someone that's going to be there, and we will get the information to you. I just want to share with you that our convention is just that. It's a time for fellowship. It's a time for sharing the experience, strength, and hope. But we do it in a very Native American style, and we do things a little bit different. But it's all Native American, because we believe that you know, that this is our way, and it's not any different but to keep us sober. And so we've got this wonderful man that's going to speak he's going to be our Saturday night speaker, but he's coming from Colorado Springs, and he's going to teach the medicine wheel concept on Friday. Now, he took it took him 5 years to translate the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous into a Native American Wellbriety book. So he incorporated the philosophy, the Native American philosophy of the four directions, you know, the four colors, the four races, you know, the seven, you know, all of the, encompasses all of creation and how we fit in the big scheme of things. And so I hope that if there is a strong interest and a desire, and the registration's only $30. So you guys could have come to that one and not come to this one. But a lot cheaper, I'm just kidding. But we feed you entertain you, and so it's, you know, we have a powwow on Saturday night, and we have a dance on Friday night, and so I think it's well worth your money. Okay, now for the reason I came. Again, my name's Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January the 27th, 1987. When I like to start from the very beginning, because, you know, it helps me, it keeps me focused, and it also reminds me of where I came from. It's not why I became an alcoholic, but it certainly is a way to help me to understand why I became one. And it certainly made everything more clear when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the youngest of eight children. I have five brothers and two sisters, well, four brothers now. I just lost a brother about a month and a half ago. My mother was full-blood Cherokee. My dad was Sioux from South Dakota. My dad died. My mother was 35 years old. She was pregnant with me 2 months when my father died, and she had seven children under the age of 13. Now, my mother did not drink, but my mother had a lot of her own, you know, her own stuff. And I think that was one of the things that that caused her to be the way she was. And, you know, in fact, with other experiences. But I came into this world, I think, with a lot of grief, because my mother, you know, my brother was 7 months old. My brother beyond him was 2 years older than him, and my brother beyond him was 2 years older than him, and the two, you know, it was ever, all of my brothers and sisters were 2 years apart, except my last brother and me. We were 14 months apart. And now my two older siblings, they were like 3 years apart. The rest of them were 2 years apart. My mom and dad were herbalists, so they, in fact, we lived for up until I was 12, right on the other side of Knoxville, down around Cookville, Sparta. We were the only Indian family down in that area. And I was over in Gatlinburg, and this lady was doing the time sharing thing, and she said, you know, she was talking about who she was and where she was from. And I said, she said, I'm from Sparta, Tennessee. And I said to her, I said, you know, I used to live in in Walling, which is like 14 miles from Sparta. And Doyle, you know, I went to school at Doyle Elementary. And she said, "You did?" And she said, "You're that family?" And I and I'll tell you what a novelty it was. And she continued to say, "Well, you know what?" She said, "My brother and me, my parents would take us down to McMinnville to visit my grandparents." And she said, "And the highlight of our trip was we'd be going down that way, and as we got closer to Doyle, my daddy would say, 'All right, kids, get up and look. We're going to pass the Indian house.'" So, you know, even then, I mean, we must have been so. But you know, that was really weird because we were the only Indian family there. And then when I was 12, when we moved back to the reservation. So, but the thing that I remember about growing up was that my mother would not let me touch her. You know, she wasn't affectionate. She wasn't nurturing. She never told me that she loved me. She didn't tell me positive things. In fact, she didn't tell me a great deal of, she didn't tell me a lot of stuff because we didn't talk. I remember growing up, and my mother was a very angry woman. She was, again, like I said, she was a full-blood Cherokee, and she was an extraordinary lady. She was incredibly, she knew just about everything and anything and a little bit about everything, as it seemed. She was a basket maker. She spoke fluent Cherokee. She could cook anything. She made peach brandy. She made blackberry wine. And I remember people would come to our house and she would sell that to those people. But anyways, as I was growing up, there was a lot of abuse in my house, a lot of emotional abuse, neglect. There was a lot of physical abuse and sexual abuse. And so as I grew up, I never knew, I didn't know what love was. I didn't feel loved. And my mother was saying to me as we were growing up, she would tell us, she'd say to the girls, she'd say, "You don't need a man. You don't need a man. You know, you learn how to be independent, self-sufficient, take care of yourself." She said, "You don't need a man." So that's all I heard, you know, and it was ingrained in my brain. And so as I got older and, you know, my body started developing and, you know, I got to looking at the opposite sex and, you know, I was getting all attracted to, you know, thinking this boy's cute and that guy's cute and whatnot. And I was thinking, but I don't need a man. But my body was telling me, but I damn sure want one. And so needless to say, my mama lost that. So I, you know, my way of thinking was, and I, you know, my mother didn't tell me anything about my body growing and what to expect, and we just didn't communicate. So everything that I learned either on my own or, you know, I just haphazardly. And so as a result, I thought sex was love. And so I became very sexual. And that was my way of communicating to others that I loved them. And then, of course, after that, after the physical attraction would wear off, then, of course, I was about my way. And so I, you know, as I got older and when I was 17 was when I first started drinking. My brothers and sisters drank, and so I was all around it, and the violence and all of the things that comes along with drinking, I was in the midst of it. And so it wasn't a new thing to me, but I didn't like beer, so I started drinking whiskey right off the bat. And I drank alcoholically. I drank to get drunk. And I didn't know that there was any other way to drink. And so that's how, and I had blackouts at the jump start. And that didn't scare me because again, we didn't talk. I didn't tell anybody, and nobody, you know, and of course the ones that I was hanging out with was probably experiencing the same thing. And so it wasn't like it was any big deal. But the shame and the guilt and the anger was very present in me from very early on. And I remember being angry with God because my life was the way it was. I had a lot of shame and a lot of, because we were very poor. We grew up very, very poor. And as I understood after my dad died, life changed significantly for my family. And so we, as long as I knew, we were very poor. And so that's how I grew up. That's what I knew. And so when I drank, it just was like the magic pill that made everything okay. It made me feel as if I was okay on the inside and on the outside. My mother would call me names and put me down, and I couldn't learn as quickly as she had hoped that I would. And so as long as I was drinking, I was feeling acceptable. I was feeling like I fit in. But when I was 21 or 22, I had met my husband, my son's dad, when I was about 20, and he was a drug addict, strike number one, and then we got together, and I fell in love with him, as well as I knew what love was, and I got pregnant, and then we got married, and I had a baby boy. And I remember when I was pregnant, I didn't want to do anything to harm my baby. I know as I get into AA and in my recovery, and I think about God and when he was in my life and how he worked in my life, even then he was very present. And so I didn't want to do anything to hurt my baby. And so I didn't do anything to harm him, as he was growing. And so when they brought him to me in the hospital, I wanted a boy so bad, so very bad, that I thought for sure I was going to have a girl. And so they brought him to me. It was, when he was born, and I asked the doctor, I said, well, what is it? And the doctor said, Patty, it's a bald-headed boy. And, you know, at that point in time, it didn't really matter. I just wanted to hold him. And I remember how wonderful and what a beautiful gift that was as I looked at my baby. And I saw, I didn't have to look at him. I didn't have to explore to see, make sure he was okay, because I knew he was perfect. Well, the thing that I look at the disease of alcoholics works in our bodies is that, and how powerful and how cunning and how baffling it is that even as powerful as having my own child in my arms wasn't powerful enough to keep me sober. It was about 6 months after he was born, my alcoholism escalated, I was off and running, and that's what happened. I drank for many, many more years, and I turned 30, and I'm drinking and I'm driving and I'm having accidents and I'm fighting and I'm doing all of the things, and I'm having this relationship and that relationship. And I had said earlier, that I heard this one lady say about how much she liked men, and I thought, well, maybe that's the way I was. She said a man would pat her on the head and her pants would fall down. I thought maybe you ladies could identify. And so I'm in and out of relationships, and how it's going, and I'm turning 30, and I'm getting old here, and I'm thinking I'm gonna get old and be an old maid. I need to find me a man. So I went to my, to the place where I find men, to the bar. where there's a lot of them, so I get hooked up with this guy and ask him to marry me, and then of course we're I was in a hurry. And so we get married, and he's a drug addict, so You know, and I'm thinking, I'm trying to put a square peg in a round hole here, and it doesn't go. And so I'm drinking, and he's drugging, and my son is like 7 years old at this point. And so I'm trying to have this marriage, and as sick as both of us were, you know, it just wasn't gonna be. But one of the things that I experienced in this relationship was something that I had not experienced up until that time, was that this man had a tongue sharp as a razor, and it would rip me to shreds verbally. I didn't have a defense against that. I didn't know what to do. And so that was something I never had any experience with, even as big as my family was and the stuff that I had experienced, even the amount of abuse that I'd experienced already. I didn't know how to deal with that. And so he would do it, and then he would, you know, 10 seconds, 5 seconds of just ripping me to shreds, and then he would follow it up with, "I love you, you know, but I love you." And you know, again, God was so very present in my life that I knew that wasn't the kind of love that I wanted. I didn't understand it, and so I couldn't live with it. So I began to pray. I began to pray, and I'm still actively using, and I'm asking God to help me to get out of this relationship, because I didn't know what to do. And I saw my son being caught up in it, and I didn't know what to do to protect him. And I did love my baby. I love my baby more than anything. I just love to drink as well. And so I begin to pray, and I'm at work. You know, I'm working at the McDonald's, and I'm there doing cleaning tables and doing this stuff, and this lady comes in, and she's my sister's friend and my friend as well, and she says, "Patty," she says, "did you know that your husband's running around with so and so?" And a big old knot came up in my throat, and I didn't know what to say. What do you say when someone says something like that to you? And I said, "No, I didn't." And she said, "Well, everybody's talking about it." And she said, and I just kind of like swallowed real hard, and she said, "But I just let everybody know that you already knew." And I said, "Well, thank you." And I just kind of, you know, I went and asked my supervisor if I could leave, and so I left, and I went to this lady's job. And because I knew her, I, you know, knew her very well. And I said, I went to her job, and I said, "Can we talk?" And she goes, "Sure." And so we went in her office, and I said to her, I said, "Have you been seeing my husband?" And she said, she stood there for a second, and, you know, and we're both, it's, you know, it seems like forever. And finally she said, "Yes." She said, "I've seen him." She said, "I've seen him several times." And I guess at that moment I must have had stupid wrote across my forehead, because I, you know, it's kind of like the insanity of this whole process. And then she said, "I've seen him several times." And then she followed it up with, "But he really loves you." And I'm thinking, oh, okay. But you know, it was really a time for me to be able to be relieved, because at that point I just hugged her neck and I told her thank you, because I knew that he wouldn't be honest with me. So I proceeded to go home, and there he was, and you know, and I said to him, I, you know, and so our marriage dissolved. And so I, you know, and there was, you know, and when I got into recovery, then I began to realize that, you know, this was this was the way he was raised. You know, he was only treating me probably the way he saw his dad treat his mother, I guess. I don't know. And I continued to drink. We went our separate ways, and I continued to drink, and I almost had a nervous breakdown. And in spite of the sadness and the pain and the addiction, there was this emotional part that I felt like I was losing it. And so, and by this time I have tried to go back to school, you know, back to Western, and trying to go to class. And I finally get to the doctor, and the doctor doesn't inquire anything about my background. She just sees what kind of state that I'm in. And she gives me 7 antidepressants to take a day. And so that's what I was doing. I was drinking, and I was, you know, taking these antidepressants. 7 of them. And I, you know, and I didn't, she didn't ask me about drinking. I didn't tell her that I drank. And so we just kind of, you know, I took them and went out the door and was hoping that it would help me to pull it back together. And somehow it did. You know, I don't know. I just kind of, in spite of my drinking on top of it. But I would continue to drink, and I continued to take the medication. And I did that for about 3 months. And then I took myself off. But while I was on it, my friend and I came over to Asheville, and we were partying. And this is my pretty much my party area between, well, anywhere between here and Cherokee, wherever I, you know, wherever I stopped. We'd been to Asheville, and we were going back home, and I blacked out at the wheel. And I hit one of those big old orange and white construction barrels, and a piece of concrete came out of the bottom, and it hit the windshield, and I came out of the blackout, and I was dragging it down the road, and I pulled over to the side of the road, and I get out and I pull it out from underneath my car, and I throw it to the side, and I'm, you know, and I get back in my car, and I go back, I get back in my car and drive home. And so I get her up and out of the back seat, and we go in the house and go to bed. And this is my normal pattern for 17 years. I would get drunk. I'd start drinking. I would get drunk. I would black out. I would drive to wherever I'm at, drive home, and then I would go in my house, pass out, get up the next morning, run to the window, and look to see where my car was at. And then I would breathe a sigh of relief. I would sit down in the couch or whatever, and then I would think about what happened the night before. And I would, that was my pattern. And when I drank, my morals, my self-respect, everything that I believed to be true about myself would go out the window. So I had a lot to ponder on, because I knew that when I drank, I knew how I behaved. And so, but that was my pattern, and sometimes the shame and the guilt would be so great that I would feel like, okay, I'm gonna rearrange my drinking behavior. I'm gonna rethink what I'm doing to myself, and I'm not gonna do as much, or I'm gonna do it different. And so I was beginning to do those things. So I ran to the window, and I saw that I had wrecked. I remembered that I had wrecked my car, and I did $1,800 worth of damage to my car. So they came and got it and took it off, and they repaired it and brought it back, and still was not enough to keep me from doing it again. So I continued to do this. This was in 1986, in the middle of 86 and towards the end of 86, around December, my friend said to me, she said, Patty, she said, would you like to move to Asheville? And of course, you know, with the being a lion, you know, cheating, you know, a thief, and, just not being really, really dishonest. I said to my friend, I said, this family, I said, would you keep my son? Because oftentimes I would just kind of farm him out to other families that would be gracious enough to keep him. And so I thought that was, and people had talked to me about my drinking. But my feelings were, because I had grown up taking care of myself and surviving, that it was nobody's business. I wasn't affecting anybody because I took care of myself. And so I had that attitude, you know, I don't affect anybody, so don't bother me, you know, with my, you know, about my behavior. And so I would farm him out, and he would stay with these people. And so I said, I told him, I said, I'll come back and I'll get him. I'll get a job and I'll find my own place. And, you know, you guys have probably have done that, you know, just making it sound like a real good story and convincing people that, you know, that it was doable. But it wasn't in my case, but that's what I said. And so I went to, and moved in with my friend over here in Asheville. I was there about 3 weeks, late December, 1st of January, and then, of course, Super Bowl Sunday rolled around. And she had went out for that weekend. She'd went to see her boyfriend. And so I, then that Saturday night, the 26th of January, the couple across the hall had asked if I wanted to come over there and watch the pre-Super Bowl ball game. And I said, sure. And so it was a man and his wife and another guy. And so I went over, and, you know, and they had plenty to drink. And, of course, I started, you know, doing the things that I did best, and that was to drink. And so that was all I could remember. And then when I came out of a blackout, I was in my apartment, and this lady's husband was raping me. And, you know, I knew that I, you know, that what was happening to me was not good. And I didn't understand it, but I was too drunk to do anything about it. And I know people get, you know, I know people get raped, women get raped, and, you know, it happens. But in my case, that particular night, that had to happen because there was another experience, another event in my life that had to happen simultaneously in order for me to get sober. God had tried to get my attention so many times before, and I wouldn't listen. And I kept on, and I kept on, and I kept on until this had to happen. And it was almost like he said, okay, Patty, you know, these things happen, and you continue to put yourself in these kinds of situations by making decisions that make you, you know, put you in the condition where you can't take care of yourself. And so whenever it was over with, early morning rolled around, and this was early morning, and I was feeling all this shame, and I was feeling all of this anger and fear and guilt. And I wanted to talk to my mother. Now, I'm not very close to my mother, but I love my mother because she was all I ever had. I had no grandparents. My mother never remarried. I never saw my mother with a man, so I had no frame of reference to what a relationship looked like in any sense of the word. And so my mother was all I had. And so I called to talk to my mother. I just wanted to hear her voice. And so when I called, there was no answer. And so I called my sister's house, and my niece answered, and I said, where's Grandma? And she said, my niece said, Grandma's had a stroke, and she's in the hospital. Well, I immediately threw all my stuff in the car, and I left a note for my roommate, told her that about my mom, and I left, and I drove to Cherokee as quickly as I could, and I went in to see my mother, and my mother was okay. She had a stroke, and she was mobile. She was okay. She still was paralyzed, but she was going to be okay. And then on Monday, I focused on myself, and I went to the doctor. I told the doctor what had happened, and my doctor sent me to outpatient treatment. Well, at the time, I didn't know that's what it was, but when I went, I went in, and I saw my therapist, and I said to him why I was there, and he said, he began to talk to me, and he wanted to talk to me about my drinking. And I said, well, I didn't come here about my drinking. That's not a problem. And so he kept switching me back, and I kept switching him back to what I was really there for. And so finally he found a way in there, and he said, Patty, let me ask you something. He said, if you had been sober, he said, would this have happened? And God gave me a moment of clarity. And the truth was in my heart. At that moment, I could see a sober Patty, and I could see a drunk Patty. And without a doubt, they were two completely different people. And so the truth inside of me was, no, it would not have happened. And so that became the beginning point of the honesty and the realization of my alcoholism. And at that moment when I began to acknowledge and to begin to accept my alcoholism, then I began to feel this great feeling of release. It was an incredible release that I felt, an incredible, unbelievable sense of relief. Because, you know, all of my life I believed that something was wrong with me. Something was terribly, terribly missing in me, and I didn't know what it was. Now, I'm the kind of person that you don't have to fix it. You tell me, you help me find out what the problem is, and I'll fix it myself. And so when he helped me to understand that, and I was willing to acknowledge my own alcoholism, then I knew what to do about it. because I knew how to work on it. I had tried to talk to people all of my life about what was going on inside me, what was I was experiencing. And oftentimes they would repeat, they would say to me, "Patty, there's nothing wrong with you." And so I found out later in my recovery that I was talking to either people that were as sick as me or people that were sicker than me. So, because I was damn sick. And so, you know, and so that was a beginning for me. But the other part of it is that my mother's dying, and I'm wanting to drink. I'm wanting to drink so bad because I had been violated. I didn't know this until I come into to recovery, that nobody has the right to touch my body. Nobody, unless I give them permission. No one has a right. And I was violated that night. And so I didn't know this very simple awareness, which made a big difference in my life. And so as I began to grow and I began to watch my mother as she began to fade away. And I knew she wasn't going to get any better, but I wanted to drink so bad because I wanted to deal with the shame that I had, but also the anger at God because he was taking my mother away. He was, not only had he taken my dad away, but he's now going to take my mother away. And she's the only one that I've ever had. And how dare he? How dare he take my mother away? And so I went through that, the anger and the guilt. And then towards the end, I began to pray. And as I'm getting sober, more and more sober, I'm beginning to realize that I laid in the bed at my mom's house. And I asked God to bring my heart back. And for all of my life, up until that very point, January the 20th, you know, right towards the end of January of 1987, I had wanted to be somewhere else. I wanted to be in somebody else's body. I wanted to be in someone else's home. I wanted to be in somebody else's family. I wanted to be in another town. I wanted to be in another community. I was never okay about being in my own skin. Until I prayed this very prayer that very night, and I asked God to bring my heart back home. And at that moment, there was a change in me as a human being. And I began to, the changes began to take place. And I was 10 months sober before I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to understand, and I felt, for the first time in my life, I felt like I had come home. I came into these rooms and I heard people like you sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And there would be sometimes that I would hear individuals that they had the courage to share the very gut level experiences that they had. And it gave me the courage to keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back. I did exactly what they instructed me to do. They said, get a sponsor and work the steps and keep coming to meetings. And I would go to meetings, and in fact, I know I'm different because I loved meetings from the jump start. And so I was emotionally on my knees. I was ready. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And so as I began to work the steps and I began to realize how powerless I was over alcohol, I personalized it and I understood that when I started drinking, I was powerless over my tongue, I was powerless over my behavior, and I was powerless over my actions. So I created a lot of pain and a lot of hurt for a lot of people. And my life was unmanageable, and even though I tried to hold down a job, and my coworkers never once believed that I had an alcohol problem. Even when I would come to work, you know, smelling, you know, of reeking of alcohol because I'd been out all night. And so even then, and they would have to help me or they'd have to, you know, carry my load. But when I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, I began to understand, you know, that my life didn't have to be like that, that I could be sober and things would be different. That, you know, and again, that awareness of the sober Patty and the drunk Patty was completely two different people whom I didn't, you know, whom I knew neither one very well. And so, but when I made a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God as I understood him, that was the crux of my program. that was the beginning when I turned the corner, because either I did or I didn't, because those three steps to me decided how well I did my fourth and fifth and on through the 12 steps. And so then as I began to turn my life and will over to the care of God, and when I understood and applying that and taking the rose-colored glasses off, I began to see my real behaviors, the choices that I made. You know, when I came home one time from Asheville, my friend kept saying, "Patty, stay all night. And I said, "No, I'm going home. And so I get in my car and I drove and I'm driving and I get to Maggie Valley at the top of the mountain, and I'm so tired and I want to, you know, I'm about to go to sleep and pass out, and I pull over to the side of the road, I roll the window down, and so I drive on home, and it's about 3 o'clock in the morning. I get home and I get into my house, and my niece is taking care of my son, who is 2, and my niece is 13, and so she had put a terrycloth jacket on top of her lamp. It had fallen over, and the house was thick with smoke. Now, that's my understanding of God. You know, there's been other situations, you know, when I wrecked and could have killed my friend and could have killed somebody else or myself, or, you know, or made them wish that they were dead. You know, driving in blackouts. That's my understanding of God, you know, in the fights and the relationships, the abusive relationships I was in, and I was able to come out fairly unscathed. That's my understanding of relationships, of my understanding of God, when other people don't make it out, you know, for some reason. And so, because certainly I made the same decision. And so when I, doing my fourth step, making a fearless and moral inventory of myself, you know, I looked at that, and of course they told me, they said, you know, you do your fourth step by what you did to other people, not what people did to you. And so that kind of, you know, changed my whole perspective around, because I spent all of my life thinking about what other people did to me, giving me reason, justification to continue doing what I was doing. And so when that happened, it began to take form. One of the things that I heard about the fourth step, and maybe you ladies have heard this before, but I was in Canada, and this man spoke on Friday night, and you know, and he gets to his steps, and he gets to step four, and he said, you know, step four is like having an orgasm. Yeah, that's what I said. And I thought, now, you know, I never heard anybody say that. Step four is like having an orgasm. I guess everybody has a different fourth step. But and so so then I went away thinking, now I've never heard that. And I studied on it. And so then I was scheduled to speak Saturday night, the next night. And I'm sitting there. I mean, I've come to my conclusions now. I've thought about it and processed it. And I thought, okay, I know now why he said that. So I get up there and I said, "Where's Curtis?" And Curtis is sitting over there. And I said, "Curtis, now I know why you said fourth step is like having an orgasm." And I said, "But I realized that's why all these men get stuck on step four." You know, you've heard him say, "Damn, I can't get past that step four." It kills me. So, you know. But I doing my step four, and certainly moving to my step five, and when I got to my step five, there was this man had come into town, and he was an evangelist, and he was a drug and alcohol counselor, and he'd been in AA like 22 years, and I went to hear him. Speak at the church, and after he got through talking, and I went up, and I was in a lot of pain, and I was crying, and I talked to him, and he said, "Patty," he said, "have you done a fourth step?" And I said, "No,"
And he said, well, you might want to think about it. And he said, now this is on Friday night. This is on Wednesday. And he said, on Sunday, I'm leaving to go back to Oklahoma. He said, I'll talk with you before I leave. And I said, okay. So I go back and I get out my fourth step because I'm in a lot of pain. And I start doing my fourth step. And I work on it all night Wednesday night or as much as I can. And all day Thursday as much as I can. All night Thursday and all day Friday. And I'm getting really physically sick at my stomach. And by Friday afternoon, I feel like I am so nauseated, I'm going to throw up. And I'm trying to clean house and do as the fourth step directs. And so I went up to see this to the church, and I asked the pastor. I said, "Where's Jim?" And he said, "Well, he's visiting another family." And I said, "Well, where's he staying?" And so I found out. And I left a note at his place, and I asked him to call me. So he called me about 10:15. Well, by 10:30, he and I were meeting together because I asked him, I said, will you do a fifth step with me? And he said, absolutely. Well, it took me about 5 hours to do my fifth step, and I was crying the whole time, and I was hurting. And right at the end, he said to me, he said, Patty, he said, you've got to take all of the stuff, and he said, you've got to give it to God. He said, you've got to give it to him because he won't take it. He said, you've got to pull it all out and give it to him. And I said, well, that's what I was doing. And I was, and I did as much as I possibly could, humanly possibly could at that point where I was at in my recovery program. And so he said to me, towards the end, he said, my head is about this thick because I've cried the whole time. And he said, Patty, he said, I want you to take everything that you know about God, and I want you that you've heard about God, everything that you've read about God, everything that you've believed about God, and I want you to push it down into your heart. And so I'm sitting there, and my head's about this thick, and I'm bitterly trying to do this. I'm just kind of like, and my head just kind of rolls back, and it feels like my eyes have rolled back a little bit, and something comes out of my mouth, and he grabs my hands, and he pulls me forward, and I'm, my face is laying in my lap, and he said, Patty, he said, I'm sitting there, and he said, how are you feeling? And I've got my head, laid in my lap, and I said, I'm okay, and he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I'm all right, but I won't raise my head up. And he said, are you hurting? And I said, no. And he said, are you hurting anywhere? And I said, no. And he said, my left arm is tingling like little needles are sticking at it. And he said, well, how's your head? And my head is still in my lap, and I focused on my head, and it was as light as a feather. And I raised up, and I looked, and I said, it's gone. I don't have a headache. And he said, Patty, God took it. He said, he took it, and he said, you don't have to look back anymore. He said, you never have to look back. And in the big book, it talks about, we don't want to live in the past, and we don't want to shut the door, but we don't want to live there either. And so that, to me, is really significant about how that makes sense to me, which allows me the courage and the strength to stand before you and to share some of the things that I've shared with you tonight from the bottom of my heart, because this is exactly what I've experienced. And so I believe that the fifth step is, it's equated to, going to the dentist and you've got this toothache that you've been guarding for months and maybe years because you're afraid to go to the dentist. And when something cold hits it, it shoots a sharp pain. When something hot hits it, it shoots a sharp pain. And when you bite something, it shoots a sharp pain. And, that's how we guard our secrets. And we guard it, and it takes a lot of energy. And you go to the dentist, and the dentist says, okay, this tooth has got some really deep roots, and I'm gonna have to pull it out, and it's gonna hurt, but it's gonna bleed a little bit, and then it's gonna heal over, and you're gonna feel like a brand new person. To me, that's the fifth step, pulling it out by the stuff out by the roots, and giving it up, and letting go of it. And, you know, having, you know, being entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. You know, I think about my defects because I have plenty, you know, being a liar, cheating, a thief, and you know, creating a lot of wreckage, you know, and doing all of these things in people's lives as well as my own. And the things that gives me hope is looking towards spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And doing the things, you know, having, you know, making a, you know, knowing that these are things that I can improve upon, and then humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Again, that's an ongoing process for me, you know, because I'm a human being, and certainly not perfect. But because of this program, it allows me to be able to look honest at myself, and to begin to work on changing and becoming a better human being. And then, you know, made a list of all the people that I had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And, of course, step 9, making direct amends. You know, making a list coming out of step 4 is, you know, is very apparent to me. And then, of course, you know, the other, making the direct amends, you know, kind of, you know, as it says, except when to do so would hurt them or others. And so one of the major amends that I made along with myself was the one that I made with my son. And I used to let him drink with me. You know, he was 5 and we would drink together, and I drank wine by this time, so he would say, "Mom, can I have a drink?" And I would say, "Sure." You know, and I'd say, "Let me pour you some." And so he and I'd sit, and, you know, we'd get and, you know, sit down on the floor, and he and I would drink together. Now he's 28 and he's out there doing his own thing. And so, you know, I have to be held accountable for that. And I have to know that, you know, I opened the door for that to happen. You know, but also I also know that that, you know, the same God that took care of me and protected me will take care of him, as, you know, as he did me. I have to believe that, because I can't, you know, I can't make decisions for him. He's a grown man. And so, but I made my amends to him, and I had done this, you know, he was 12 when I got sober, and so I'm, you know, all these years have gone by. And I was in school, and I was in graduate school in 99 and 2000, I think. But having that conference in Cherokee, they flew me in from St. Louis, and I got to speak at that conference, and that, well, what an honor that was. So I spent time with my son, and never has our relationship been as close as it is now. But until that particular, you know, that particular time. And so I'm saying to my son, and, you know, I'm still, you know, trying to figure out why he's so angry with me. And he said, and he said to me, he said, "Mom," he said, I said, "Well, why?" He said, "I'm really angry and I don't know why." And because, you know, as I have grown in the program, I have become a different kind of mother, and I've tried to make, you know, life easier. And so he said, "I don't know why I'm so angry." He's 25 at this time, and I said, "Well, if you had to guess at it, what would it be?" And he said, "I think, Mom, what it is," and it was interesting how he said he didn't know, and then all of a sudden he recalled it just like that. And so I said, he said, "Mom, do you remember when you got married at 30? He didn't say that. He said, "When you got married to that man." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you see, what I had done is I left him with my friend. And prior to my marrying this man, it was just he and I for the most part. And so I left him with my friend. I married this man, went to South Carolina and married this man, came back, and we were married. And there I surprised my son with this man, and whom he knew, but not in that capacity. You know, he didn't feel threatened as long as we were just seeing each other. But once he became my husband, he was very much threatened. And he said, "When you married him," he said, "that made me feel like that you chose him over me." And he was really crying, and so was I. And I said to him, I said, you know, I have never, ever made a decision and just hurt you. And I said, I made lots of decisions that caused a lot of pain to a lot of people. But I never intended to hurt you, ever. And I said, I am sorry. And at that moment, our relationship turned a corner. It turned a corner, and it's been different ever since. And so now he calls me. I don't have to chase him down, but he calls me, whereas in the past I would have to, you know, chase him from state to state to try to find him and to see where he was at and just to say hello and to hear his voice. So our relationship has changed, but those were the kinds of things and the amends that I was making, you know, making to my brothers and sisters and to my friends and other people that that was in my life, because I didn't know what love was. I never knew what love was because I never felt loved. And although I knew my mother loved me, I knew it in my head, but I never felt it. And I didn't know it, what love was, until I did step three and understood what unconditional love. See, when I started doing step three, and I said, you know, turn my life and will over to the care of God as I understood him. You know, when I looked at real situations, that I made clear decisions, and, you know, by putting chemicals in my body, and then the reality was that I caught myself in all of these situations, and yet something shielded me. Something guarded me. Something protected me. And that had to have been my higher power, the God of my understanding. So that was my understanding of God. So I knew that, but that was the love that I understand today. It's what I, you know, how God loved me when I didn't love myself. And so that made everything make sense to me. And so then, you know, continued to take personal inventory of myself when wrong promptly admitted it. I think that's the most marvelous step. You know, I mean, they're all marvelous, but, you know, this one is incredible because it allows me to lay down at night and go to sleep. It allows me to have a clean, you know, a clear conscience, because if I feel like that I've hurt or said something or done something to hurt someone, which because of this program I would never do because I know what pain feels like, and I wouldn't want to inflict that upon anyone, you know, intentionally. So I have a responsibility to myself and to my relationship with the God of my understanding. So that's a pathway and a tool that helps me to be able to sleep at night and to correct it if I need to, if it needs be. And sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him. You know, praying for his will for me and the knowledge to carry that out. The power to carry that out. You know, I know that, say, in the serenity prayer and the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, all of these prayers is, you know, the resentment prayer. All of these prayers are ways to help us to get over hurdles and to get over situations that help, that make life easier, and relationships, certainly relationships, smoother. Because that's what happens. Because, you know, God did something for me that I couldn't do for myself. And then, of course, having a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, you know, and then carrying this message to other alcoholics and practicing these principles in all my affairs. I'm telling you, this is the life. It doesn't get any better, I don't think. And we keep, you know, we keep experiencing the promises. And, you know, prayers, I mentioned to you a little bit about going to graduate school. It took me 23 years to get my bachelor's, you know. And 15 schools. But, you know, it took me 23 years to get my bachelor's, and it took me 21 months to get my master's. So, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. But, you know, prayers work. And I didn't have any money to go to graduate school. And God gave me, he saw to it that I had a scholarship that paid the whole, you know, gave me a full ride. And I'm not all that smart. So Washington University in St. Louis and was, you know, came back to Cherokee and started working and back home. And so, you know, prayers work and miracles happen because I'm a living testimony of that. Because I would have, where I came from the bottom of the barrel. And, you know, when I came out of which many of you probably did too, you can identify. And so, but when I came out and each time I would try to make a step forward, pulling myself out, someone seemed to always step on my fingers, and so then I would have to start over. And that's what I've been doing all of my life. And then when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe God introduced me to AA, and AA introduced me to God. I truly believe that. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful life from day one, although painful. But wonderful. I want to share this joke with you, and then I'm going to close up. And you've probably heard this. There was a man and a woman. Their names were Jack and Debbie. They got a job at the same place, doing the same job, and getting paid the same amount of money. And the boss just loved them both. He just thought the world of them. And he just raved about them. But, the job was, you know, hitting a lull. And he found himself realizing that he was going to have to lay one off. But he didn't know which one to lay off. He was just torn because he loved them both equally as well. And so he thought, well, okay, I know what I'll do. I'll stand by the drinking the water fountain in the morning. And the first one that comes up, that's the one I'll lay off. And so the next morning, here comes Debbie, and she's staggering up to the water fountain, and the boss is standing there, and he's waiting on her, and he said, Debbie, I need to talk to you. Well, Debbie's been out drinking all night, and she's got a hangover, and so she says, well, wait just a second, boss, let me get me some water, and whenever I get finished, we'll talk. So boss stood there, and he said, okay. And so she got her water, and she got finished, and she said, okay, boss, what do you want to talk about? He said, well, Debbie, he said, I've got a problem. And she said, well, what is it? He said, well, I'm going to have to lay you or jack off. Debbie said, well, you're going to have to jack off because I've got one hell of a hangover. And with that, I would like to say thank you. Thank you so much. Oh.